What's going on? It's your boy Tyrell Deshawn, the R&B sensation from Pure Brands ENT, and you are now rocking with Miss Robin Lynn on Vibes Live Radio. Keep the vibes live, you dig?
Hello, I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com.
I say the hip hop, you just don't stop it, and just get ready to jam with Disco Daddy, Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on VibesLive.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here, welcoming you to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. And as we walk down the yellow brick road of hip hop culture, which is now worldwide, we're stopping along the way and speaking with icons, pioneers, and legends of the industry about this worldwide culture and their place in it and the market they've made. We've got one man on us on our show today. He's an OG, okay, out of New York City. And if you ever wondered about who some of the first B-boys or B-girls were and where the term came from, well, this is probably one of the few living authorities on that subject. His name is Anthony G. Horn. He's known and beloved by the name of Charlie Rock, however, in hip-hop, and he's well-respected as an academic as well as a hip-hop trailblazer. He's going to go into his life, and when he talks about his life, he'll be giving you a slice of early East Coast hip-hop from way back in the day. I mean, from when everybody, when a baby must crawl before they take even baby steps. Well, he's going to take you back to when, before hip-hop had a name, it was crawling. It was a movement, however, and he's going to illuminate that side of it. Mr. Anthony G. Horn on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop. What's up, Charlie Rock?
What's good, my brother? Disco Daddy, a legend in your own right, my man. A legend in your own right, absolutely. What's happening?
You're very kind, my brother, but I all heads must bow when they talk to someone like you who was there in the beginning. And that's why you're on the show today.
Everybody out there,
if you want to know what it was like in the very early days, this is one of the few remaining members, because, as you know, people are starting to leave us from that period of the first B-boys to dance on the planet Earth. Mr. Charlie Rock is one of them. And he can name a few names that came before him, but you could count them on one hand. So this is how far back this brother goes. This is how far back this brother goes. You know, he bows out to a couple of people, but at the same time, he was there to even see them. You see what I'm saying? And to interact and let you know what it was like during that early period of hip-hop. Mr. Charlie Rock, we're going to talk about hip-hop, but for now, just introduce yourself and your early history from out of New York City, the South Bronx, I assume. Am I correct?
Well, actually, no, the North Bronx. I was in the part that they considered the good part of the Bronx, actually. It's a very interesting dichotomy, you know. And my name is Anthony Gerard Horn. That's my legal government name, as they say. My father, my adoptive parents, I was adopted, born May 24th, 1960, and to a mother who was a teenage mother. I never got to meet her or anything, because she decided that in order for me to have a good life, she wanted to give me up for adoption. obviously being teenage pregnancy was very different from what it is today. Back
right.
in the 50s and 60s, it had a very different social stigma on it. And being a teenage mother, I believe she was pregnant with me at either 14 or 15 years of age, somewhere of that nature. And she decided that she wanted me to have a better life, and she decided to give me up for adoption, and I was adopted by Edna and Hayward Horn at 5 days old, and those are the only parents I've ever known. And my
right.
father, my adoptive father, for whatever his reasons were, I have no idea why, but I guess he wanted to give me his own name for himself,
right.
and
right.
he gave me the name Cholly, which is spelled C-H-O-L-L-Y. Okay, so you'll see it in some places spelled the conventional way, C-H-A-R-L-I-E. But
right.
I'm telling you, I've always grown up spelling it C-H-O-L-L-Y, and that's the way my father spelled it. So it's Cholly, not Charlie. So, but
your
that's, anyway,
so
I've had, Yes. So that's a name I've always had. So the name Cholly was not a name I got through dancing or gangs or anything. The rock part is, the Cholly part is from my parents and everyone in my family, cousins, grandparents, aunts, uncle, everybody, you know, now deceased and still living, knows me as Cholly. No one in my family calls me Anthony or Tony. All right?
Gotcha.
So that's how that one goes. And, you know, I'm born and raised and grew up in the northeast section of the Bronx in the Gun Hill Road, the what's known as the Williams Bridge or Wakefield area of the Bronx. And to really be able to understand the significance and the dichotomy of that, all right, because, I mean, you know, most people who are not from New York associate the Bronx with the stereotypical definition of it. So the Bronx that they are familiar with or have heard about is the South Bronx. And that's
right.
the Bronx in the 1970s was burning and abandoned. They were the victims of redlining and early blight. People like Robert Moses, who built the Cross Bronx Expressway and the Brooklyn
right.
Expressway, and in the process destroyed communities. White flight, you know, the Northeast Bronx at that time was predominantly white neighborhoods. And as more and more blacks started moving in, particularly blacks were more middle-class blacks, actually.
Right.
You know,
right.
not even too many low
right.
income. It was more middle class blacks. All right, working
you.
Income, working class, and middle class blacks in the area. You know, but the more moved in, the more whites practiced white flights. Okay.
What years is this going on right here?
Well, I would say a lot of the white flights started in the 1950s, late 1950s, when they started building towns like Levittown, Long Island. And,
right.
you know, the white star. And that was built very specifically for the white middle class.
Gotcha.
You know, when Robert Moses was designing the highways and everything, what I would suggest people read is a book called The Power Broker, which is the story of Robert Moses. And I don't want to get deeply into that because that would take a few hours in and of itself. Robert Moses had an obsession with the automobile that had a lot of racist agendas, and basically he designed and built the New York highway system. And he designed and built it in an intention to be able to lead whites who wanted to practice white flight out of the cities and to the suburbs.
Wow.
All right? So he was very instrumental in creating the suburbs. Read it. It's all very much documented stuff. But in any event, all of these things contributed to the decay and decline of the South Bronx initially.
I got you now. I see the pictures.
Because as a lot of those whites who could not afford to get out to the suburbs or to Westchester County or felt they were safe, they moved up to the North Bronx, which is Pelham Parkway, Gun Hill Road area, Throgs Neck, some places that still exist that are still strongly and predominantly white, and actually some of the most affluent communities in the country. Riverdale, Pelham Manor, Pelham Parkway, the Throgs Neck area, Pelham Manor area, Pelham Estates, those kind of places that are part of the Bronx, part of the Bronx, but you don't hear about that, all right?
Okay.
The narrative that you hear is the South Bronx, and the buildings were burning, and all those things, and that's factual, that's absolutely true. And so as those things were going on, the gang culture really took hold around the late 60s and early 70s, and that's where gangs like the Imperial Bachelors, the Savage Skulls, Savage Nomads, and for us African-Americans, the Black Spades. And you know about them. The Black Spade, right, which started with seven people around 1967, 1968. From those seven people, called themselves the Savage Seven in Bronxdale Projects, Bronxdale Houses in the Bronx, and which was actually more towards, it's like on the division line of the North to South Bronx. And they went from seven people to, at its peak, about 10,000 members strong. And its disbandment, yes, and became at its time the largest African-American street gang in the city of New York, with divisions in all five boroughs and parts of Westchester County and Long Island. So a lot of those things happened. The reason I'm telling you that piece of it is because out of that energy, the music scene that would become known as hip-hop emerged.
Right.
All right? Two scenes emerged, actually. One scene was the Latin hustle culture as well. You had the Puerto Rican cats who were doing the Latin hustle and everything like that. And that's my man, Willie Estrada. You've heard me talk about Willie, and you've spoken to him a couple of times.
I interviewed him. He wasn't a black spade. He was a member of another.
He was the supreme warlord of the Imperial Bachelors.
The Imperial Bachelors. And they were allies with the spades, were they not?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. It's funny. Myself, we were doing a presentation earlier today for my summer youth group downtown at my job where I'm a supervisor at, for Bronx Works in Bronx, New York. But that's another story. I'll talk about that another time.
Right.
But
we might get into it at the end of the show, though, Charlie. We want to know what you're doing now.
Absolutely, no problem. I'll be happy
We will get into that. But go ahead, Willie Estrada and the allies that you guys had.
Right. And so one of the ways they brought peace to the Bronx, aside from the whole Avenue Peace Treaty meeting, they started throwing parties and doing a dance called the Latin Hustle. And as you probably know, the Latin Hustle crossed over, got picked up by whites, and it really started the disco craze, the Saturday Night Fever, and all those kind of things. And so on a national level, that's what took prominence. And there were blacks, of course, who gravitated toward a lot of that, too. And so
What years are we talking now, Charlie?
We're talking now the early to mid-1970s.
Okay. All right? Early being what? 72, 73, or what?
74, up until about 78, 79 in that era. All right?
Okay.
But that was, that was what the older black people, black adults, and when I say older, I'm talking about 20, 21, you know, older compared to us who were 14, 15 years old, all right?
Okay.
They gravitate, as they started coming out of the gang culture, you know, as that started fading out, they're getting, you know, some are getting jobs. Those who were killed or in jail, they were having babies, and they were starting to put their families, and, you know, they got older, and you know, they got going into the club scene and the black club scene and everything like that. And that's when you had DJs in the late 60s, early 70s out in Brooklyn, like Grandmaster Flowers, Maboya, DJ Plummer, DJ Apple, Sidney B, the Grand Wizard of Sound, people like that who were very heavily into the black, what we call black club scene or the black disco scene, which is very different from the Saturday Night Fever kind of thing.
I know. I was a black disco DJ.
Right. So it's a difference.
I remember, you know, at that time, there was no real difference in the disco scene or black disco DJ, except, you know, basically there was no scratching. Everybody mixed back then. You mixed on the beat and all that kind of stuff. You see what I'm saying? You know, so I'm familiar with that. But go ahead, Charlie.
Exactly. But during the course of all of this, right, in the gang culture, you had cats going to clubs like the Tunnel and the Puzzle in the Bronx and the Black Spade and other gangs, and they're doing dances called like the Spade Dance. And the Spade Dance is a dance you have to understand when we were gangbanging, right? The Spade, everybody, we wore what were known as MCs or engineer boots, right? Or combat boots, engineer boots.
Combat
and, of course, they're very hard bottom. When you stomp, they make a loud sound that's very intimidating. And
The
Spade Dance was a lot of spinning and elaborate turns, you know, and those people who were really good dancers could do it in sort of almost like a war dance or a battle dance, something to that effect, all right? And especially if you're indoors on a wooden floor, that stomping, boom, boom, boom. It's very intimidating. It attracts people. It does a lot of different things.
Right.
And so that kind of dancing, along with the freestyle dancing that was going on, you'll hear people in Brooklyn maybe talk about it as rockers or whatever. A lot of that was going on. And what we call
burning. What year is that? What year is this
emerging? We're talking about the late 60s and early 70s. So we're talking about 72, 73, in that era. All right. And that's where you have the Turners.
Did that precede the Park Jams, or were the Park Jams happening that early?
Well, people were probably going to Park Jams during that time, but the Park Jams weren't what they became to be as they pertain to the birth of hip-hop.
Right.
Okay? But there were DJs playing in the parks and various places outdoors, okay?
Okay.
So in the 70s, that's where you have the first incarnations of what would become the B-Boy, which is the Burners, okay? And
explain that, because B-Boy for the younger generation means breakdancing and stuff like that. It was entirely different terminology.
Right.
Could you touch on that for a second?
Well, people would call it like you would go off or you would break, right? Yo, he broke, he went off. And in the early days of it, it was more upright. You know, wasn't a lot of
no sitting on your back and all of that.
Nah, not yet, no.
Right.
And it was like, if you saw, you know, and the best way I can explain it to you, the early days of burning would be like very similar to what you might have seen with James Brown's moves. So you have some splits, things like that, you know.
Okay.
Splits,
okay.
Dropping back, pin drops, things like that. Or
just
things like
Lock
of Dancers on Soul Train, stuff like that.
Right.
All
right?
And those are the early incarnations of what would be known as breaking or burning and what have you.
Okay.
But as it started to evolve, you had these cats who started taking it down to the floor. All right? Now, the early burners and B-Boy breakers were cats like Trixie and Sa-Sa. You know, you had cats, even Suspense, like Rubber Band and all these various people who were doing breaking or burning. And they were more upright. They weren't spinning or anything like that. They were more upright.
Okay.
Like I said, a spin here, a drop back there, a pin drop there. All right? But right around 74, 75, you started seeing, and I remember when I first started seeing it, because I was burning and dancing upright and through it, dropping back and all those things and that normal stuff too in my beginnings of it. But then I went to a club around 1974, 75, my first years of high school. I was in the ninth grade or so. And I was already a Spade by this time. I joined the Black Spade as a baby member of the Black Spades in 1973, 13 years old, second year of junior high school. Okay? Second year of junior high school. What today would be considered the last year of middle school. All right? So my second year of junior high school. And I'd already had affiliations because I had friends who had joined early. The older members, I knew a lot of them. They knew me. They liked me and everything like that. And so it was a logical progression for me. I was into school. I did well in school. I was a very gifted kid. I was an academically gifted kid. But I was also a kid who was very restless. I was a kid who probably was real angry about a lot of different things in my house, the relationship with my father, which was not necessarily a good one. He was very strict and, you know, a number of different things. I had good parents.
Right.
There wasn't a thing of being neglected or any of those. It was just me and how I processed my anger, my feelings. I grew up in the era of light skin and afros, and if you've seen pictures of me, I'm dark skin and with at the time nappy hair and, you know, and everything, and, you know, being made fun of because I'm smart. I like different things. I like to read. I like, you know, and I could take care of myself. You know, I went from being bullied to a person who could fight. So that combination, plus I could play basketball. I was a good athlete. So the combination of all of that gravitated me towards a different group of people than the people who were in my classes. You know, I had a lot of white friends who were very close to me. I had some black friends. I mean, the friends that I had in the projects, but I had a lot of black kids who didn't understand me. I didn't want to understand them, but I still had some very close friends of mine. All right. But because of my behaviors and all those kind of things, I was a smart kid, get put on detention, and I'm this kid that joined a gang, and I'm in SP, which is a special project, which is the school, a class of gifted students.
I remember
they call
that.
IGC classes. Right. You're from New York, right? So the SP, I'm
from
SP.
New York. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm an SP student, and I'm running with gangs. And I remember the principal, Joseph Bell, may he rest in peace, telling my mother, "Your son's running with the Black Spade." And my mother's asking me about it. I'm saying, "I don't know what he's talking about," but I very much am running with the Black Spade. I remember when I came and told them, my father wanted to kill me and tried to beat me to death. And I said, "Well," and I didn't. That didn't make me stop. That just made me know I'm hiding my shit.
All right.
I say all that to say that that's how I got introduced to things, because with my friends who were baby spades who had less parental not guidance, but they, you know, they were able to hang out a lot more, and I was sneaking out to hang out. We're going to these clubs. And so one of the first clubs I went to was the Hevelo, which was a club on Jerome Avenue and Burnside Avenue. And that is where the legendary Kool Herc played.
Man.
Okay? And Kool Herc, and I don't care what people say, Kool Herc is the father of this culture we call hip-hop.
Okay.
People want to get mad, well, he's a pioneer, he's a contributor. No, no, because I was around, and I went to different clubs, and I saw freestyle, and I knew what DJs played. And Herc was doing and playing something different, and he was playing something that catered to us as B-boys. And if you were a B-boy, and that's what you gravitated towards, and that's what I gravitated towards, when I first saw the twins, Kevin and Kenny Smith, Kevin and Keith Smith, and Tyrone Smith, better known as Clark Kent. That's the original DJ Clark Kent, who became Herc's DJ protege, along with the Imperial JC a little later on. But those were the original A1 B-boys. And when I see the original, I'm talking about B-boys, as you know, it's spinning on the floor and all that. And I saw that. And
so
I was
by
like,
this time,
this is what,
by the time Herc emerged, then there was getting down on the floor.
Oh, absolutely. That's where it really started, in the Kool Herc parties.
I got you.
And the Kool Herc,
I was going to ask you what made him different. Okay.
Exactly. He played music that catered to us. Kool Herc.
To the B-boys and B-girls.
On the Coke LaRocque. All right?
Okay.
And they were MCing. Coke LaRocque is rapping on the mic. You know what I'm saying? It was MCing. Yeah. Not the way you know MCing today with rhyming and rapping. But, you know, Coke LaRocque with the Echo Chamber. And they're playing songs like Apache. Kool Herc songs, B-boy, original B-boy records. All right? Obscure records. There, very few of them were mainstream records. And you understand what I'm saying, particularly being from New York. You know, there are records that are played on the radio, top 40 records that are played on the radio.
Right.
You know, back in those days, WLIB, WWRL, Super 16, with Jerry Bledsoe, Frankie Crocker, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. This is before Disco 92 and all of that. I'm talking about WLIB, WBLS. There were certain songs that were played, and there were other songs that really didn't see that kind of airplay, or they'd see a little bit of it.
Right.
Most of the original B-boy songs are songs that were fairly obscure. They weren't popular top 40 songs. One or two,
they were local
maybe
hits,
Scorpio.
Local
something like Dennis Crossley, Scorpio, one of the early break records, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something like Africano, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the original version of Africano, or That's the Way of the World Now.
Right.
Original break record. Something like Soul Makossa, you know, Mano de Bango, Soul Makossa. Those are original break and burning records, and a couple of others. But Herc was playing a whole other playlist. Herc was playing Apache from the Incredible Bongo Band. Apache was such an obscure record that we as B-boys, particularly Uptown, remember Uptown is a very different vibe from the South Bronx. The North Bronx vibe is very different. You know, you got residential communities, houses, a couple of projects scattered here and there. That's how I come from the project.
Right.
I'm from Gun Hill Project. You know, we had Eden Wall projects. Our rivals up there. And then you had projects like Gun Hill that were more like working family class projects. So it wasn't a lot of, you know, wasn't a lot of welfare families that here interspersed, but most of the families were working. So it was a different mindset. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it wasn't a lot of neglect or anything like that, you know? We had private houses uptown.
Now, the other thing, when you say obscure records, the thing was, because you and I remember those things they used to call record stores when you go in and buy it.
Absolutely.
You couldn't find records like Apache. That was the thing. Even though your DJ was playing it, what made it probably more wanting to go to Herc's thing is because when people probably heard him play the records, they go to the record shop, they couldn't find it. The only place you could hear it.
Not only could you not find it, but this is what I got to tell people, because you get all these people today who want to claim, they want to take a piece of claim of they started hip-hop, we were this, that, and the other, Brooklyn, all these other places. Not only could you not find most of those records, they didn't want to play them if they did, because they were not, they specifically were not catering to us. They did not like what we were doing. They did not like B-boys, and they didn't want us at their parties. They called us floor sweepers, yo-yos, boy-yoings, jitterbugs, and the term that later became our moniker, hippity hoppers.
Hip hoppers. It was a derogatory term in the beginning before hip hop came to be embraced by a term.
It was
a derogatory. Wow. Okay.
Absolutely. This is before my man Cowboy embraced it and started using it in rhyme. All
right.
Right.
Okay.
You know, because that's the story.
So all
that's
the other theories out there. All the other theories about it, of who did this and who did that, it doesn't really matter because the term was in use, but in a derogatory way.
Exactly, exactly. It was a derogatory term
very
to describe the B-boys and the fact that we were jumping up and down in their eyes. We were doing an art form.
Makes sense.
We were doing an art form, yes. But they called us jumping up and down, all right? And we called it,
at what point,
right.
Go ahead. At what point, Charlie, did you join that diaspora of the B-boys?
By that time, 1974, I was already burning. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw Clark and them cats, I was hooked. I was like, yo, this is what I love doing. And especially being, in that day, I mean, I could actually dance. I could hustle.
Wow.
I could dance any kind of dance. But in the beginning of it, I didn't do a lot of hustling. And girls like cute boys, and I wasn't a cute boy. I wasn't any of those things. I had a lot of women who liked me later on, but I wasn't a cute boy. And they liked the cute guys and all that, with the afro.
And you don't have any girls out here.
And they were doing the little hustle. I had friends who were doing the hustle, and a lot of them later, they were kind of gay dudes. But that's another story altogether. And I could do the hustle. But my thing, I found that this other dance I could do, and it was a good release for my energy. I had a lot of energy, and I had a lot of anger, and it was a good way to release that energy, and I was good at it. I was good at it, and I got a level of acceptance with it. And so, then remember, by this time, I'm leaving junior high school. I'm running with the spades, and I left junior high. I graduated from Olinville Junior High School 113 in the Bronx. And I attended one of the most prestigious high schools in New York City, which is the prestigious Bronx High School of Science.
Yes, sir.
Why I went to high school.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
And of course, you from New York.
You have to take a special test
to
get into that school. You got to take a special test to get into Bronx Science.
Absolutely.
And have high scores from your own junior high school. I mean, you got to. I have great respect for you, my brother, to get into Bronx Science. Get into Bronx Science or High School of Performing Arts, Music and Arts.
Yeah, exactly. You remember the specialized high school? Stuyvesant High School, Brooklyn Tech,
You had to have
special
talent,
Absolutely.
I remember.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So I wound up going to the Bronx High School of Science.
All right?
And, I'm there, and I'm doing my little thing, and I'm running around with the gangs, and I was doing okay in school, and as I told you, my father and I had a very volatile relationship, and he did something one day in school that really got me angry and embarrassed me. And, from there on, I kind of really didn't want to go to school. I went, but when I was going, I would be cutting up and hanging out. I'd go in for tests. I'd go for the test. I passed the test. I'd go in, I'd not be in school for 2 and 3 weeks. I'd walk in on a test take at 85, 90. And then leave again. And
I do that.
And teachers were like, I can't pass you if you don't come. I can't.
You got so much potential.
Yeah. But I was so angry and I was so invested in what I wanted to do and the rebellion that I was just like, I'm doing what I'm doing. And so, but I was still b-boying. And so my friends in Bronx Science liked me because, Bronx Science is considered a nerdy kind of school. And, to give your listeners a good perspective on Bronx Science, don't know, my classmates in Bronx High School of Science were Neil deGrasse Tyson. Okay, the astrophysicist.
Yes.
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
The most popular astrophysicist in the world, actually.
Yes.
Okay.
That was one of my classmates in Bronx High School of Science. His roommate, when they went to Harvard, was one of my childhood friends that I went to science with, Ross Addison, all right? My boy, Frank Vincent, that I used to play ball with in Bronx Science, is Dr. Gregory Vincent, who won the Supreme Court battle recently against affirmative action.
Wow.
When the Supreme Court was trying to, the Austin, Texas, University of Austin, Texas,
I remember they were trying to, they challenged the provisions.
Right, this just happened recently. Well, he is the lawyer who won that Supreme Court case. That's my boy from Bronxville. Okay? So these are the people that I went to school with and having fun with. Okay. And they love me because, one, I played ball. Two, I'm smart. Three, I could fight, and I was with a gang, and I was popular. So it's like, that's our boy. That's our friend. We know Charlie. And you know what I mean?
Right.
We could go, they could go places, and people won't bother them.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And being a member of a gang had its own purpose, especially the biggest gang, because I go play. People ain't going to mess with me
because
I got a crew.
There
you know
what
I'm saying? And I can fight. And I can dance.
Right.
So, thing. So our B-boy thing was a thing of rebellion. We were renegades. And it wasn't even about, well, you know, people want to talk about white people. White people weren't even in the mix because they had no idea what we were doing. They weren't around us. They weren't even around us. The people who were rejecting us were black people.
The other black people, right. Okay.
Were black people.
This is a new, something new emerging that they couldn't understand, been wanted part
they
of their...
understand it.
Right.
They wanted to reject it. And this is the thing about black people. We are an extremely divisive culture among us, our own, where they feel if we're not doing something that is socially acceptable to the status quo or to where they're aspiring to be, then they want to down it.
Now, one of the people that, from back in those days, and we're not saying this in a derogatory manner, but there's someone now who has started the Universal, one of the people who started the Universal Hip Hop Museum, and a lot of people from back in your time are surprised that he would be a person who would start a museum like that.
I know you're talking about. Yeah, go ahead.
His name is Rocky Wakanu. We just talking history. There's nothing bad about, you know, but he was at one time doing this type of sex.
Yes,
that
I have nothing against
him.
I know for a fact he was not. Mm-hmm. He was one of those people who did not embrace b-boy music because it wasn't being called hip hop yet.
Right.
But the culture was already the. It's like that, and I've explained it in the analogy on the comparison of having a baby that you couldn't decide what to name yet. And even though it didn't have a name, it's still growing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
But in its early stages, and even as it was being called, Rocky and them were adamantly against it. Rocky had a crew, had a crew of DJs. And they remember, they're from my area, the Northeast Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And they played in a club called the Stardust Ballroom. And a close friend of mine who was, I won't mention his name because he was him and his family were affiliated with, you know, organized crime. Just put it like that. And they were heavily connected into the Stardust, and they were good friends of mine because I was into a lot of things, and they liked and they respected me. And so I was very tight with the people in the Stardust that owned it and ran it, and I used to do a lot of things in there. And so I used to go to the Stardust. So I'm a cat that was a B-boy in one era, dancing with my sneaker and all that, and I'll throw on a suit and shoes and go and do the hustle in the Stardust ballroom. And the reason that's important is I saw both sides of the culture.
Right.
So I think authoritatively about the fact that there was a group that did not, they were adamantly against what we were doing. And Rocky was part of that group.
Now,
they did not change that crowd.
To be fair and spread it around a little bit, what about DJ Hollywood's crowd?
He wasn't in it. Nope, them either. And I have nothing against Hollywood. I love his music. So, Hollywood was a great DJ.
Right.
He was not catering to that crowd. Him, Junebug, none of them were. None of them were.
So,
Junebug
embraced
the little
Rocky Bacano. It's just that Rocky stands out because later he wants to start the Universal Hip Hop Museum. But that surprised a lot of people.
That's the only reason we mentioned him. But it wasn't just him. Rocky, Hollywood was not about it. Eddie Cheever wasn't about it. P.D.J. Jones, the legendary P.D.J. Jones, nor his wife Becky. I keep telling you, people think about the first female DJ. Well, Becky D.J. Jones is one of the early female DJs, but she was not a hip-hop DJ.
But because she played disco music.
Yes.
Right.
They played black club music, and they did not play B-boy records. And seeing that B-boy records and the B-boys, us, and the DJs who played them, which were a select few, we are the foundation of what came to be known as hip-hop. And that wasn't really taking place in Manhattan, definitely wasn't taking place in Brooklyn.
Okay.
That was just not the scene.
Okay. Now, Charlie, we got 2 minutes. Man, I could talk to you all day long, my brother, because you sort
of
scratched
the history, brother, a lot of history.
Yes, you do, and you're very concise. But we got 2 minutes. We want you to bring us up to speed on what Charlie Rock is doing now. You had mentioned some of the things that you're doing now. You got 2 minutes to fill
us in. Oh, absolutely. Yes, sir. One of the things I like to tell people that, yes, I'm considered a pioneer and all these kind of wonderful things, and I smile because I understand it, but the reality is I was just doing what I enjoyed doing as a part of my youth, like a number of us. I mean, Tony Fugilaland, you know, I always have to shout him out. My brother, the legendary Clark Kent, the twins, Kevin and Keith Smith, you know, numerous other people, Grandmaster Flash, Afrika Bambaataa, the original Zulu Kings, my family. As you know, I'm one of the original 11 Zulu Kings, you know that, and all that kind of stuff, and we'll talk about that another time. But as I like to tell people, that was a part of my childhood and my youth, and we grow. I went away to college, straightened my life out, went through all the various street things, got my degrees. I hold a master's degree summa cum laude from Lincoln University, and I currently am the supervising educator of a program with an agency called Bronx Works, which is one of the largest community-based organizations for youth as well as adults and homeless services and homeless diversion in the Bronx, okay?
Wow.
And I am a supervising health educator for a program called the CAP program, which is Comprehensive Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention. So I train and I supervise health educators who facilitate evidence-based interventions. And so for those people who are not familiar with that from an academic perspective, evidence-based interventions are interventions that are proven through research and academic scholarly publication to work, to change behavior, okay? They are evidence-based, all right?
Wow.
And so I run and supervise educators as well as facilitate evidence-based interventions and write curriculums. I've been in the field of public health education for the last 20-some-odd years, over 25 years, I would say. And that's what I'm doing. So that's what we do. And, like I said, I'm never ashamed, and I love the role that I played in the formation of what is today a worldwide culture. But I always tell people, it was a part of my life, an important part of my life, a happy part of my life, an influential part of my life, but it is not the defining moment of my life.
Gotcha.
And that's the thing I like to, But I always enjoy talking about it, and I love my friends and my brothers. You hear me give them shout-outs, because I love my friends and my brothers who were involved with us in the early days when we were just having fun. Nobody was looking for a record deal. Nobody wanted to be a rap. We were the stars in our communities. We were the stars. We were the celebrities of our community. And we were just a group of young boys and girls who were having a good time. Shout out, like, to my girl, Sha Ra.
Sha Ra,
early B girl, one of the first female MCs, probably the first female MC. When I say first female, who was totally devoted to MCing. My girl Amber Carter, Bambaataa is one of Bambaataa's first MCs. She was a female, all right? First female DJs, Baby D, and my girl Gail Hall, respect. Gail Hall grew up in Gun Hill Projects with me. You know what I mean?
Gail Hall?
Yes, Gail Hall,
respect. Okay,
From one of the first female DJs, from Mercedes Ladies. The first
all-female
hip-hop group.
Right. I interviewed them. I'm going to have them back, too, Charlie. I'm going to have them back, too, man.
Absolutely. At Gail Hall, we grew up together. She's 740 East Gun Hill Road, and I was in 3444 White Plains Road, Apartment 80. Yeah. No, Gail, we were about 7, 8 years old. Yes.
Your memory is astounding, my brother. Mr. Anthony G. Horn. Charlie Rock, we know him and love him in hip-hop as. Your knowledge is very concise and to the point, and we want to thank you for your contributions to hip-hop, all right? And we want to thank you for taking your time to do this show, Charlie. And we want to wish you the best of health and the best in whatever else you're doing. You're giving back in what you're doing now in public health and giving back to people. And so I think you're going to be around for a while. God has a plan and a purpose for you, my brother, and you seem to be serving very well. Charlie Rock,
God willing,
the
creek don't rise. Listen, the legendary Disco Daddy, y'all. Y'all don't know. You better read about him. You better find out. All right? That's the band who introduced hip-hop to the West Coast. And health, wealth, and prosperity to you on this new adventure, on this new endeavor, brother. Feel free to call me anytime, man. Be happy.
Thank you, Charlie Rock.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to... Thank you. You've been listening to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, our special guest, Mr. Anthony G. Horn, better known as Charlie Rock. Don't go away. We've got more exciting guests coming at you this month and some special announcements. Thank you for tuning in. Peace.
Peace.
Vibes Lives has something very special for you right after church, gospel brunch, and sunshine. I am Robin Lynn, and join me for Jazz with Jay every Sunday and a glass of wine on VibesLive.com, 12 noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. If you've been following us, you know that we are having historic interviews with some of the legends and pioneers of this culture that we love. And we're going all over the world to find these people, not just here in America, but there's hip hop in Uganda, there's hip hop in Vietnam. There's hip-hop in London, Paris, and Rome. Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop will be touching bases all over the world. Today, we have a man that some of you know and some of you don't, Mr. Derek L. Simmons, better known to us in hip-hop as G-Rock. Are you out there, my brother?
Yes, I'm here in flesh.
All right. What we're going to do today is talk about yourself, your history. We're going to go back to your childhood, and what brought you into this culture that we know as hip-hop? And you can start at the very beginning where you're born and raised and the influences around you, what was going on, the flavor, and then we'll get into your practice, my brother. Mr. Derek L. Simmons, G-Rock.
Yep. Well, it all started back in, I was a young kid. Like I said, I was... Raised, my childhood was in Plainfield, New Jersey. That was the home of the P-Funk. So I grew up listening to George Clinton, and so I was always around music and stuff. And coming up in the 70s, as you got up into the 70s, I got older and stuff like that. And my love for music grew, man. And 77, the end of 77, I was actually on the West Coast. I actually went out to the West Coast. I had a cousin out there that his mom wanted me to go to school with him, for the 10th grade. And I was out there in 78, actually. That's why some of my early dancing roots, that was the first things that I learned. I learned how to pop lock and, break dance and all that stuff. At the time I went back to Jersey, yeah, it was funny because I was in the beginnings of the West and the East. So,
all right, hybrid, hip hop hybrid.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, okay. And then when I moved back to, to Jersey, my mother had moved to Newark. So I didn't go back to Plainfield. I went back to Newark, New Jersey, and that's when the hip hop kicked in, Okay. So, from that point on, I was already into the music. And so when it came up, I just started writing right away, and the rest is history. Yep.
What year was this that you decided to start exploring?
I wrote my first rhyme in, my first one actually in 79, which was where I wrote my first rhyme. It was... And you know, back in them days, as well, is that there wasn't no 16 bars and 8-bar hooks and all that. We just wrote. So I wrote, my first rhyme was 10 pages long. And I was proud.
You memorized it, my brother?
At that time, it was the excitement, you know, the adrenaline. And,
okay.
And I remembered it. I remember it well because it was that what's that song? Christmas Rap. That just came out. Yeah, it was around the holidays.
Mm-hmm.
And Curtis Blow had the record. You know, on the first side it said Christmas Rap. On the second side it says Do Your Own Rap.
Right. So remember, I remember
that's
that.
That's what got me. You remember that? He said, rap
yes, sir.
Thing.
Yes, sir. I got one of those in a record pool.
Right. That kind of enticed you. They're like, all right. Well, I played that instrumental for hours, man. When I got done, I had a 10-page ROM. And from there, I just kept on going with the 10-page ROM. It was like the earliest form of freestyling like they do now because we was able to write until we blew in the face. But, you know, when regulations came through, you know, I started writing the 16s and all that stuff. And I was, you know, I really got serious about 81, 82, you know, deciding I wanted to, I wanted a record out, you know. I wanted to go for it and everything. And at this time, I was by myself. So, you know, I acquired all of the skills, you know, which I still have knowledge of, you know, like the production, the writing, making the beats, all that, you know, manufacturing, everything I had to do.
Were you performing? Were you appearing as D-Rock during this time also, honing your rapping skills? And did you use the name D-Rock? I mean, when you early first started, what were you,
D-Rock
did you come
was,
out?
Well, the first name I had was Gangsta G. That was the first name I had, you know, off the cuff. I just called myself Gangsta G for some reason.
Okay.
But,
I got you.
You know, and then people in the street, once they got to know me, they rarely called me Gangster G. They all cut it short and called me G. So that eventually became, you know, my attribute became G. And a young dude around my way, he's a real cool guy. I mean, he's real young too. He used to always call me G something. Like, hey, what's going on, G Boogie? What's up, G Rock? When he said G Rock, I said. I said, and I kept that. Like, he gave it to me, but I kept that.
That's that, yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
And I had it ever since, man. Ever since, like, 82, man, I had that name. So,
you know,
it's embedded in my old, you know, lifestyle.
So your first venture into recording professionally happened how?
In 1985, I had got out of high school and everything. In high school, I was doing talent shows and everything. But when I got out, like I told you, I wanted to go for the gusto. And it happened in, like, the end of 84. I met a guy. You know, I was somewhere performing at a talent show. And he got with me and he said, yo, you were so good. He was, you know, like somewhat like a fan or something. But he was saying he wanted to get into, you know, managing an artist and all this and stuff. And then we hooked up and everything, and he started managing me. You know, he wasn't a manager before, but he started managing me, you know, and at the time I had a DJ with me. So he managed us and stuff like that, and I was with him a couple of years until I eventually went on my own because I felt he wasn't getting me where I wanted to go. So I kind of branched off. You know, I was trying to learn the business through him and kind
of
branched
off
on my own. Yeah, that happened about, like, in the late 80s, like 88, 89. You know, I started doing things on my own, you know.
Mm-hmm. You have a massive amount of work.
Yes.
Okay. Explain to us that period when you created the amount of work that you have. You could probably release material for years if you wanted to. Explain to us how that came about.
All right. Well, off the cuff of what I just explained about the manager, you know, when before I left, we had a falling out. And because I was the producer for his independent label. And I did all the music anyway for, like, artists that came in and stuff like that. So, you know, when I left him, I just kept on going. Well, I was angry too. At the point, and I just started making all kinds of songs.
What year was it that you left and went on?
That was 1989.
Okay.
When we last when we last worked together. I was actually on a tour. It was actually Public Enemy's second tour. I was on that tour.
Wow.
And they came to Jersey, and they did the whole tri-state, and I was involved in that tour. Actually, let me give you this thing that, you know, the manager did for me. This is the one good thing that he did that I can honestly. He signed us. We were the only unsigned group that was signed to Famous Artists Booking Agency when they first started.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? We were the first underground artists that were signed to them when they first started. Everybody else was major.
Wow.
And that's how we got on the PE tour in 89.
Wow.
And then we did that after the tour, then I was out. So I was on my own. In 1990, let's say 1990, from that point to present day, you know, I was doing my own stuff. And like I said, I did the production, the written, and everything. So I was just started knocking them out. You know, I was going,
right.
Man. I just started knocking out the songs, and after the songs became albums, and I was doing albums like on GP on the weekends and stuff like that. You know, it started adding up. You know,
James Brown of hip hop, baby, 3 months together.
I was on a mission, man. You know, but it added up, you know. So that's how I got into doing all the songs, and then eventually I brought under some artists under my wing, and I started producing them and stuff because I had so much stuff I couldn't use all of it for myself. So I started writing at artists for a while too. So I embraced all the areas of that.
Okay. Your tour with PE, that must have been for you monumental in quite a few different ways. You're on tour with a major artist who at that time, which still is, they were kicking butt everywhere, every stage they appeared at because they were,
they were
radical or considered, perceived to be radical. What was that like?
Well, it was, you know, when we did the tour, like I said, we were unsigned artists. And, well, me, I was the only rapper and I had a DJ, but we were opening for the shows. We were actually the first group that opened up as well.
Okay.
So for me to be, you know, to be the first person on stage in a major tour, that was unheard of, man. I was real happy with that. I really enjoyed that tour. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And it must have been a learning experience. Basically, what did you learn as a performer that you hadn't known before you got on tour?
Well, I learned how to communicate with the audience. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I had problems with that, you know, and say, you know, within myself, you know, I never was a stage guy that went out and just performed and entertained in front of the crowd. I could do it, you know, you know, if I had to, but I was mostly like a lab rat. So
producer.
I would do the shows.
Right.
I had to do it with just me and the DJ, but
I enjoyed most
being, making the music, you know, being in the studio, man. I enjoyed that more. So
is that still the same?
It was a learning thing. Just learning to deal with it. That was the learning curve. Just learn, you know, if you're going for the record, you got to perform. You're the only person.
Right.
I could do it. It was no problem doing it. But that, you know, that was my favorite. Yeah.
Are you still more comfortable as a producer and a music creator than a performer to this day?
Yes, that's the answer to your question. I mean, of doing all this music over the years is that, you know, that's my first love right there. You know, I love making the music. Mm-hmm. I love being creative. I love being creative and innovative.
Okay.
So, you know, one year, I can tell you too, I think when I ran across you and met you, I said that I had, you know, got a world record. I had a world record for putting out the most albums in 1 year.
Right. I remember that conversation.
I actually put out 20 albums in 1 year.
Oh, man.
And I did those albums that year. It wasn't like stuff I had and collected it. No, I did those 20 albums in that one year. I think it was like 2007. It might have been 2007.
Wow.
And that same year, I was in Business Magazine, Business Week Magazine. I was first getting online and navigating online and stuff. I was on there early, and I wanted to make my own YouTube page. You know, after I seen YouTube, I wanted to make my own, and I started it on some platform. And they saw it. Whoever it was, they were struggling. And they saw me do it. And in 1 week, I had like 20,000 people homing in on my page. So they immediately called me. The cameras came out and everything in the magazine came in. So that was another, you know, that I'm proud of too. They're doing they're really big now. They're doing very well now.
They're called
Ning.com. If you know that name, it's Ning.com. Well, actually, you know, they tell me that, you know, they still probably, you know, really helping them out off the ground. So that's another thing I'm proud of as far as that angle. But, you know, like I said, I really do love, you know, playing the back and being creative. And, you know, I like to work, you know.
Okay. Now, you're based in Philly, or are you in Jersey now? Where are you based now?
Yeah, I'm in Jersey. I'm based in Jersey. I've been here the whole time. You know, I'm in Orange, New Jersey now. But when I started, my hip-hop group started in Newark, like I said, it went for 20 years in Newark. So.
Well, we know, like, Queen Latifah, a couple of people. Were there any other people that were coming from Jersey, representing at the time, during your formative years, that were or working around your contemporaries at the same time, any names that we might know that represented the Jersey hip-hop country?
I mean, a lot of those names, like Queen Latifah, Naughty by Nature, Lords of the Underground, and The Outsiders, you know, all of those guys.
Right.
They know me because I'm like one of the first. I'm like actually the first person to put it down for Northern New Jersey.
Okay.
I'm the OG. I'm the original OG. So I,
okay,
you know, a lot of them
I
worked with before they went on to do their thing. I'm proud of a lot of them because I actually worked with them on their way to getting where they are. And you know, a lot of them went on to be legends. So.
Wow.
Yep. And
basically,
in New York as well.
Okay. I know you have great respect. I can see it on Facebook from everybody.
A lot of the old school legends and stuff. I've worked with them over the decades. Yeah, you know, they all know me. I'm like one of the rare guys, you know, from the underground that's known in mainstream and everywhere. It's because how long I've been out there, and I've played the back.
Right.
Like I said, I like to make music, produce, and I did a lot of beats for people and songs and stuff like that, you know, so.
Okay.
That's what I love. No. That's what's the part that I really love.
I got you. Now, you have an award that you had created, which you've been giving to deserving artists. Tell us about that concept, how that came to being, what that's all about.
The Hip Hop Culture Awards. Yeah, how that came about, you know, it was a couple of years ago. I was a nominee, you know, to get an award, you know, at the time. And you may know the name of the organization. You might have seen it. It's called Team Fearless.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
they had an award thing too, and that the guy that was the CEO was Tito, the Devastating Tito from Fearless Four.
Devastating Tito, right.
Yeah, so, you know, he nominated me the year I met him. You know, he got with me and we talked and everything. And he met me and learned my history and saw a lot of stuff, all the stuff that I'd done. And he nominated me, you know. So, and what happened was that one show, they had been doing it for like 4 years, and that was the fifth year coming in. That one show, you know, due to situations beyond his control, it didn't kick off.
Okay.
You know, the nominees were nominated. Everything was set up, and you know, whatever happened with that happened. But You know, and I felt kind of bad for him, and for myself, it felt like a miss for me.
I remember that.
Yeah,
I remember
that.
You
know what I'm saying? Instead of me being angry, you know what? I said, you know, my whole motto became, look, we are not going to be denied. You know, we're not going to be out. And then that thing, no matter how hard you try, you can't stop us, became our permanent motto.
Right.
So
right.
I said, you know what? It's not about me. It's not just about me. You know, I was, very excited and flattered to be nominated and that, but I said, you know what? There's a lot of other people that deserves it as well. And I just started hitting somebody. I think I hit one person up that I was thinking at about the time that was nominated that year with me. And then it just just went on into it. Yeah. And then as I started doing it, everybody, because it was easy. The way I did it, it was easy for me to do it. It was a virtual award.
Right.
I had created the symbol, and it was very easy to nominate and induct everybody. So I just went on.
It was beautiful also. It was beautiful. I got one, and I was very appreciative that anybody would even think of me in that respect. And everybody that you've given it to has shown appreciation to you, brother, for even thinking outside of yourself about the other's contribution to our culture.
And that kept me motivated because every time I would read their comments, it was like a acceptance speech. Everybody really. They took pride in that virtual award. So I kept going, man.
Yes.
I mean, I'm past 500 now. So,
man. Okay.
Yeah,
that's
and that started
thing.
For me not getting in the war. So I said, look, I said, everybody's going to get one now,
Out of a negative comes positive.
I created the HACA, and I get like hundreds and hundreds of hits on there every day,
Wow.
So it's very informative. I actually have a website for it as well. I don't know if you went to the website yet, but I do have a website, an actual hall, like we call the hall, I call it the Hall of Pioneers. So, there is a physical website, where everybody's name there, pictures and, stuff, written about them. So I wanted to solidify that I did that as a rebellion, but it worked in a positive way. So.
Right. Worked in a positive way.
Yes.
Okay. Now you have, what are your current you have some projects that you're working on now that I've seen you make some posts about. You want to tell us about that?
Now, the one that I have now is I'm working on with an associate of mine. He's like a little brother to me. Everybody knows him as, the Rhyme Inspector Percy P. And I came up with this project. Actually came up with it because me and him were talking about it. We talk a lot about the old school and stuff like that. We have I'm sure you have conversations like that with people, friends. And that came up, that the record store came up because we were talking about wax and the longevity of wax and vinyl. And I was like, I got to give them their props because I used to go to this record store for like over 25 years. And they're still there standing, doing pretty good. So I said, I'm going to give them their props. I mean, that's one thing. I'm always thinking. And I said, we're going to do a promo. We're going to do the promo. You write your thing. I write my thing. Then we're going to do a video for it and everything. It's going to be the biggest honor to an institution that deserves it. And nobody done anything like that. So I said, I just started doing it. I made the track. Okay. It took me 2 days to do the track. And then I sent it to him. He wrote his verse. I wrote my verse. We dropped it. Now we're at the point right now we're getting ready to do the video part. And it's really doing very good. I mean, this early, so fast. There's a lot of buzz out there. I'm in a magazine already. So, I didn't think it was going to take off like that, but I'm glad it did because they deserve it. They deserve the honor that we're giving them. So,
well, let me ask you this. Because you're one of the few artists I can talk to who's come from a period where there was vinyl and record stores.
Yes.
What do you think of the change from everything going from vinyl mom-and-pop stores and the availability of being able to walk down a block to a record store and buy an artist record to the internet where you have all these different platforms, Spotify, Tidal, iTunes. How does an artist navigate through all of that? And would you prefer the old system where people actually could just go buy your record, tape, and CDs? Or do you think that this system that we have now, which is going to be here forever, is actually better for an artist?
I actually think it's better for an artist, you know, especially the artists now, you know, because these young artists, you know, they don't know about, you know, the days back. You know, like me and you are fortunate enough to still be here. We came from the analog era into the digital era, so we can appreciate it a little bit more because, you know, we have more knowledge of the transition and we can compare and everything. I can say to you, when I first got on the internet, I was elated, man. I was happy and you know, satisfied because I had a thing with the industry anyway. You know, I've been independent since 1990. So it was definitely a good thing for me. But you know, talking to the youth, you know, I mean, going from there, you answer your question from there to here, there's some good in both. You know what I'm saying? I really enjoyed buying the records, you know, and going out searching for the records, like you say, going to the store and picking out the records and all that stuff right there.
And finding something that you wasn't expecting to find.
Yes. And they've missed that. You know, that's something that they're not going to see. I mean, they had a little resurgence of it. You know, it's a little piece of it back here, but it's not like it does. That's why, you know, I had to give props to that store because I'm like, yo, they're still around selling vinyl. I mean, this is something I used to do. I don't even DJ no more. I used to DJ for 25 years, and I used to go there every week. Every week I used to go to Rock and Soul over in the city. You know, they were over in Manhattan on 7th Avenue.
Right.
So, you know, it's good in both, but I think the now is better. I mean, especially for people like me and you.
Okay.
Because, you know, without the internet, I don't think we would be trying.
No. And that's another question I was going to ask. Do you think, it's another question I'm going to ask you, because it took 5 years for me to come back from obscurity.
Right.
Where people simply now recognize what I've done, and it would not have happened without the internet, Facebook specifically. MySpace, when I got into that, that became more of a dating game type of website. You know what I'm saying?
Because it was new social media. Yeah, it kind of faded out. Yeah.
Right, I left it because Facebook seemed to be sort of more tailored to me, at least during a time when what happened with me, my daughter saw some stuff. She said, "Dad, didn't you do so and so?" And there's somebody else on here saying that they did this. You know what I'm saying? This was like 2007 or 8, you know, when the internet was new. It was just my book. And so then I started actually paying attention to the internet and realized that the only way I could, you know, negate those things that people were you know, to start a page and stuff and do that. So it has helped me to where now I have the respect of other OGs like yourself to come on and do the show. But along with that, I realized that all you G's got stories to tell that are never, unless written a book or something, will never be known. And we got brothers popping off in their 40s and 50s now. So can we expect a book from Derek L. Simmons, G-Rock, in the future?
Yes. I'm writing it now. I'm writing
You got a working title for it?
Well, the name would be Urban Legendary. That's the name of the book. Yeah, and that's talking about, you know, me coming from, you know, the management all the way up until, you know, the independence and all the people I work with and the things I've been through in the industry and stuff like that. So it's definitely going to be a nice... Definitely going to be a nice story to read.
That's beautiful, because we need all of our brothers' stories and sisters, because collectively, if people read your story, they read another brother's story from the OGs, they get a collective picture of what it was actually like. You know what I'm saying? They get a more, each one of y'all books would be a slice of the hip-hop pie, hip-hop history pie, in other words. You know what I'm saying? And over a period of time, academics and scholars who do study these things will be able to read the story from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Not somebody's interpretation of what you said or a third-party account who happened to be there when you made this. You know what I'm saying? With your own total experience. What advice would you give now to young people entering business, specifically hip-hop and hip-hop recording? Do you think that the award shows like the BET Awards and some of the mainstream awards accurately reflect the state of hip-hop and the amount of talent that's out there?
Personally, I would say no. But I would never tell someone, you know, to not, you know, work. You can work towards something like that.
Uh-huh.
You know, and work, you know, and always put 100% into what you're doing, because in this era now, with the digital era, you know, you could pretty much make your own. You can do it yourself, even if you don't get a record deal like that or anything. You can create your destiny. You can create it. You know, I mean, you know, I know that because I have done it. You know what I'm saying? I mean, like me and yourself, I was on the internet for about 10 years, you know, before I started early, right in the beginning, before MySpace and all that. And at this point now, you know, I'm at the place where I wanted to be, you know, putting in 25 years. You know what I'm saying? In 10 years, I did it on the net.
Mm-hmm.
What I could have, should have done in 25, you know, on foot. So it's definitely, you know, worth going for yours and stuff like that. I don't like when they don't put 100% into it, like this, the rap today. You know, you have some people that don't really, you know, put the mind, body, and soul into the lyrical content. And,
right.
And things of that nature. It's all about the marketing and promote. I think that part is really, that's unfortunate. But you know, they're using that more than letting the artists, you know, use their more of their creativity and, you know, innovations. So that part I can see the difference between when we came up and like now. You look at the way it is now. You know, we definitely were more diverse, more creative. You put more heart and soul into it.
Yeah.
That's why it lasts so long.
Yes.
You know what I'm saying? Yes. I remember hearing Gigolo rap with a Daddy and Captain Rap. You know what I'm saying? I had it. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So, you know, even though you say obscurity, I knew who you were, you know.
Okay.
I came from that era.
right. Exactly.
I know who you are. So,
thank you, my brother. Thank you.
I had the records. I was DJ first. I had the records.
Okay. So there you go. Now, where can people go, G-Rock, to purchase your music?
Oh, they can go anywhere, man. iTunes,
Amazon.
You know, they can just Google me, man. I mean, I got into the...
All under the name G-Rock, though, right?
Yeah, they can just...
Oh, you recorded always under that name. Okay.
Yep. G-Rock and the CND Coalition, yeah.
Gotcha. Yeah. And you got a Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram?
Yeah, I got them all. Yeah.
All right. So, and those are under the name Derek L. Simmons, however.
Yeah, most of them
in other words, they type
under my stage name, but, you know, Facebook is under Derek L. Simmons. My Twitter is under G-Rock. You know, stuff like, so it's different.
Okay.
But like I said, if they Googled my name or searched it, they would see all of them right there lined up. So, you know, it's probably better to Google me, and then they could see whatever they want to see, man. I mean, I worked hard for that Google.
I got you.
I mean, I'm at the level like the pros, the legends now. You can just Google me and everything's out.
Yes, there. I just Google. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I worked hard.
Well, you know what? We want to thank you, Derek L. Simmons, G-Rock, for your contribution to hip-hop.
No problem, man.
We want to thank you for
pleasure.
Your... Okay, we want to thank you for your time doing this show, and we want to wish you the best for the rest of your career, my brother. And if there's any way Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop can support you in your music. I'm just a text away, my brother.
Okay, and I thank you because you already
have. All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, man. You've been listening to Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. We were talking with Derek L. Simmons, better known as G-Rock, one of the most prolific hip-hop producers, unknown and known, because there are a lot of us who do know about him. But my audience out there, Google Derek L. Simmons or G-Rock, and you'll find and discover a whole world of music you didn't even know was out there. Thank you, G-Rock.
Peace. Indeed, man. It's my pleasure, like I said.
All right.
Yep.
But so, wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Central Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic, epic. See you next week. Bye. Wow.